It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business.
It was a clear black night, a clear white moon. The Express is on the tracks, trying to consume all these market dynamics. What's making stocks swoon? Why investors are piling in when the rally left the room? What's making yields pop and semis drop? Why the S&P looks shaky up here at the top? Why oil prices are rising? There's no supply shock. Why inflation's still sticky, watching the Fed like a hawk? Be a predator, not a prey. Let's get it on like Marvin Gaye. Sectors are rotating, changing sets like a play. Fundamentals are essential every night and every day. No shortcuts here, gotta play the right way. Know your limits, know your lines. Set yourself up for success. Punch or kick it, let's get wicked on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard, and you may want to grab a handrail as sector rotation is underway. The major U.S. equity averages topped yet another record high last Tuesday, but closed slightly lower, but still lower for the second straight week. Another drop in tech stocks led the slide as inflation worries sent investors scurrying for safety. Treasury yields popped over 20 basis points, or 0.2%, with the 10-year yield climbing back above 4.5%. Friday's sell-off was slightly scary, as it was one of those quarterly triple witching days when stock options, market index options, and market index futures expire simultaneously, which is always good for a little volatility and some price pressure. We know there's been a lot of bullish options activity lately, so a little pressure drop was not out of line. And with the CPI and the PPI coming in a little hotter than expected, telling us that inflation ain't over yet, all eyes are back on the Fed this week when it meets on interest rates and monetary policy Tuesday and Wednesday. No rate cuts are expected, as we all know by now, but has the Fed's tone shifted since the last meeting, given how stubborn this last leg of inflation has been? Right now, according to the CME's FedWatch tool, the probabilities of a rate cut don't get serious until the June 12 Fed meeting, where there's now a 55% chance the Fed will cut rates by a quarter of a percent. With the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq still dancing around record highs, there's a lot of people wondering if equity investors are a little too optimistic and enthusiastic about the prospect for lower rates. Or maybe, just maybe, those investors don't really care too much about the Fed's next move given the strength of corporate profits lately. As Morgan Stanley's Mike Wilson points out, the difference between the price-to-earnings multiple for the S&P 500 and the Fed Fund futures, which represents investors' expectations for a decline in interest rates, that just keeps getting wider. They know the Fed's going to eventually lower rates. Jerome Powell has said as much, and we can see it right there on the dot plot. And since the market is around record highs and the economy seems to be stabilizing, albeit this sticky last leg of inflation, there's not a lot of anxiety about Fed rates as there was over the past 4 years. And that leads us directly into our big three for the week. Number one, it's easy to get lost in this purple haze of record highs for stocks and Bitcoin and miss some of the shifts happening intra-market. Thanks, Jimmy. The bond market seems to be taking inflation a little more seriously than other asset classes. TIPS, those inflation-protected treasury securities, have been rising a lot faster than nominal treasury yields, which tells us that bond investors think higher prices are going to stick around for a while. And commodity traders feel the same way. As our buddy JC Peretz points out, the CRB Commodities Index is at its highest level since October. Inside the stock market, the leadership has shifted from high-flying AI and chip stocks to energy and mining stocks. If those commodity prices are going higher, and the futures market tells us that they are, inflation is not going anywhere. There's a reason that oil stocks have outperformed the Nasdaq 100 so far this year, even with Nvidia and Meta. Still, investors keep rushing into stocks. According to EPFR, U.S. equity funds took in $56 billion in the week through March 13th, with $6.8 billion of that going into tech. And options traders, especially small options traders, are feeling pretty frisky. Last week, they spent 46% of their total volume on buying call options to open. That's tied for the second highest amount in the past 2 years. Who's going to be wrong here? Number two, is 2024 starting to look a lot like 1995? Adam Turnquist, the chief technical strategist at LPL Financial, points out in a recent note that a lot of conditions are similar. For those of you not around in 1995, or those of you who need a little refresher, Michael Jordan came out of retirement wearing the 4-5. DVDs were invented, Netscape, the OG web browser, went public and was the gateway to the internet for most of us, and Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise was the song of the year. R.I.P. Coolio. As Turnquist writes, after stumbling into the start of the year from drastic Federal Reserve rate hikes in 1994, the S&P 500 quickly regained its footing and rallied consistently higher throughout 1995, amassing 77 record highs along the way. That was the most all-time highs for the market in history. And if you're a math person, 77 all-time highs in a trading year breaks down to a new all-time high every 3.3 trading days. Euphoria and no volatility. The maximum drawdown that year was only 2.5%. also a record. Roll back the tape to 1994, and the Fed had doubled interest rates from 3% to 6% to battle an inflation wildfire. The bond market spiraled into losses, and stocks faded into the end of the year. The drumbeat around a recession was deafening, but then it stopped. Inflation stabilized, and the economic expansion resumed. By the summer of 1995, the Fed cut rates, and the stock market sprinted to a 34% gain by the end of the year. To be sure, 2024 is very different from 1996 in innumerable and numerable ways. But just to keep some perspective, the S&P 500 is up just under 8% so far this year, and the market has made 18 record highs so far. Since 1950, the maximum drawdown for the S&P 500 during years with a record high averaged a drop of 11% compared to the average drawdown of 17% during years without a new high. Furthermore, annual S&P 500 price returns during years with a record high have averaged 13.7%. We're over halfway there. This compares to an average returns of only 3% during years without a record high. Stocks may seem overbought right now, but as Turnquist reminds us, overbought conditions can persist for longer than most people expect, especially in strong bull markets. And number three, it's been almost exactly 4 years since the World Health Organization proclaimed the coronavirus a global pandemic and life as we knew it changed on a dime. We were locked down in our homes, people we knew were getting sick, some fatally, our kids stopped going to school and lived their lives exclusively through their screens, some of us were washing our groceries. It was not fun. And we watched the stock market and the economy fall off a cliff. On March 16, 2020, the S&P 500 fell 7% shortly after the open. Circuit breakers kicked in at the exchange and halted trading for 15 minutes. It was the third circuit breaker halt that week. The Dow Industrials dropped 12.9%, the second biggest percentage loss post-World War II after 1997's 22.6% drop. The S&P 500 fell 12%, its third biggest percentage loss, and the NASDAQ fell 12.3%, its largest percentage loss ever. Remember, just 1 month before, in February of 2020, the stock market was at another all-time high. The market would not bottom until March 23rd, and from the highs of February 19, 2020 to the bottom of March 23rd, the market fell about 34%. And then we know what happened. The Fed floored interest rates, the government rained money on households and businesses, and by August, the S&P 500 was back to its old highs. If you need another lesson in why we stay invested, here's where we are today, exactly 4 years since our lives were turned upside down. The S&P 500 is up 88%, better than a 20% annual return. The Dow Industrials are up 67%, and the NASDAQ is up 103%. Let's get set up for the week ahead, and all eyes will be on the Fed. Make that all ears. A Fed decision and Powell's press conference aren't that much fun to watch, but we're going to be listening closely for any change in tone from last meeting, especially given the latest inflation news. Has the timetable changed for a Fed cut? Has the number of cuts gone from 3 to 2 or 3 to 4? Does the Fed expect unemployment to climb higher than 4% anytime soon? Details matter, and we're going to be listening closely for them. We'll also be paying attention to the housing sector, which is still not feeling the spring vibes. The 30-year fixed mortgage rate is hovering around 6.8%, so the icicles are starting to melt, but we're going to get the NAHB Housing Market Index report for March and a look back at February housing starts, permits, and existing home sales. The mortgage industry was rattled last week when the National Association of Realtors agreed to a landmark $418 million settlement with homebuyers on commissions. The settlement, if approved by a federal court, would eliminate the automatic 5 to 6% sales commissions for listing and sales. It will allow buyers to negotiate commissions with brokers. It will strip brokerage commissions from MLS listings. It will lower closing costs for homebuyers and will offer them more choice. And some analysts estimate that the real estate industry could lose half of the brokers and listing agents working today. And we're going to stare down another potential government shutdown this week, as Friday is the deadline for a passage of several government spending bills, also called continuing resolutions. Here we go again. And we'll get the last wave of corporate earnings reports this week, with results coming from widely held companies including Micron Technology, General Mills, FedEx, and Nike, among others. Just do it. And on Monday, NVIDIA will have its GTC, its Global Processing Unit Technology Conference for Artificial Intelligence, and that will kick off with a keynote address by founder and CEO Jensen Huang. He is having a moment. In In 2022, total taxable sales for both legal and medical cannabis totaled a little over $15 billion. The 2023 figure is still being tallied, but the growth of this cash crop, which is still a Schedule 1 narcotic according to the DEA, is undoubtedly slowing. 23 states and Washington, D.C. have fully legalized cannabis, with an additional 21 states either fully or partially legalizing medical marijuana. California, one of the first states to legalize cannabis for both medical and recreational use, has seen this slowdown firsthand. Retail prices for cannabis flower crashed 32% last year as overproduction and an overabundance of dispensaries has far outpaced demand. But California, one of the most popular tourist destinations on the planet, is trying to reignite the industry, and many cities and counties are turning to cannabis tourism to do so. Think wellness spas offering medical cannabis treatments and tours of cannabis farms and production facilities, not hanging out with Cheech and Chong in their van by the beach. I was recently invited to host a conversation at Visit California's annual gathering in Palm Springs, California that addressed this economic opportunity, the good, the bad, and the unknown. Visit California is a big nonprofit organization that supports and advocates for the tourism industry of the Golden State, and it supports what are known as DMOs, or destination marketing organizations around the state, like Santa Ana, Oakland, and Bakersfield. The big question, how does California, which has a $149 billion tourism industry, market cannabis tourism alongside family fun attractions like Disneyland, Universal Studios, and the great beaches up and down its coast? It was a fascinating conversation about a controversial industry at a crossroads, and here are a few minutes from that panel. I got a great panel here. We have Peter Gamez, the president and CEO of Visit Oakland, Wendy Hazy-Roberts, the president and CEO of Travel Santa Ana, and Brian Applegarth, the integration specialist from Destination Cannabis and the president of his own consulting firm. I'm really excited to get into this with you guys. I want to start with you two, just to level set what's happening in your area in Oakland. Where are you from a marketing cannabis perspective? Cannabis tourism, set the stage for us.
Where we're at with cannabis travel for Oakland is we're now going into our third year of this adventure. And what I mean by adventure is it was an adventure in the beginning. It was a risk. We didn't know how it was going to be well received. And it's been received overwhelmingly by the community and by travelers. So we're excited about it. We're excited to talk about it today. I do want to thank Brian Applegarth, who really was our main advisor on introducing this concept of cannabis travel to Oakland. But we organically started with Oakland because it was a very easy destination for cannabis travel to exist. So hopefully we're going to be able to explore that later on today.
Great. Wendy, what about Santa Ana?
For Travel Santa Ana, we're a brand new destination marketing organization. We were just formed in January of 2021. So when I joined the organization and saw the city and learned that we were the first city in Orange County to allow dispensaries, I saw that there was an opportunity to differentiate ourselves from other Orange County cities and sought the assistance of Brian to build a tourism program. We're in the initial stages. We have an age-gated website page that lists several of the dispensaries, not all. We have 31 approximately, but we're not looking to be business listings. We're looking to have the listings be about the experiences that visitors will have once they're at the dispensary. So it's carefully written content that's displayed.
I want to get into what that actually looks like and reads like. Well, there's a common denominator here, not just cannabis, Brian, right? Working with both of these DMOs and helping cities around California, probably around the country, think about how to implement this, use data. Tell us about your business. What is it that you're trying to help solve?
Yeah, so Applegarth Consultative Services or Applegarth Strategies, we specialize in the cannabis travel audience, which has been profiled and measured since 2019. That's something that we did when we teamed up with MMGY Travel Intelligence. We did a national survey. As of July last year, that audience is about 72 million Americans, about 37% of the active leisure travel audience. And that doesn't really account for the medical opportunity. So what Applegarth Strategies does is we have a great team and we work with DMOs or destination organizations to really understand what's the destination brand, what are the strengths. We help connect with the cannabis stakeholders. We're a resource. As we develop 12-month programs, we really try to make it fit and become a liaison to the cannabis community, bringing data every step of the way and measuring that. And also looking at the nuance of the cannabis travel audience, there's different archetypes from the canna curious to the canna wellness to the cannabis connoisseur. Also this ceremonial traveler that's really, I believe, pioneering a new vertical in travel, which comes down to wellness and well-being and balance and entheogenic travel.
Let's just level set on where we are from an economic perspective. The cannabis industry in 2023 in California from taxable revenue perspective, about $5.1 billion. Not nothing, but down about 4.7% year over year. Retail prices down about, 32% just by the measured cannabis flower. Those prices are falling year after year in this state. When you look at the overall state though, tourism revenue, $149 billion. Wine is about, $55 billion. So this is a $5 billion industry trying to hold on here inside a mega tourism industry. So fascinating to get into that. Let's talk about what's happening in Oakland. You have the Emerald Cup. You're working with the hotel industries. How are you making this partnership kind of B2B in a lot of ways for an event that people are already coming to?
Well, for those of you that aren't familiar with the Emerald Cup, how many, have you heard of the Emerald Cup or is familiar with? So it's kind of like the World Series of cannabis. I mean, it's like, we're so blessed that it's coming to Oakland. We're going to have up to 25,000 consumers descending to downtown Oakland, and everything about the cannabis world is going to be explored there. And how we were so fortunate that they selected Oakland, well, one of the reasons why is our Simple Cannabis Trail that we started 3 years ago, thanks with the work with Brian, we showed that we were a community that was welcoming these travelers. We wanted these travelers to come to our town. What I love about it as a hotelier and as a past hotelier, it meant room nights, especially during a time that we need as many room nights as possible throughout the entire state. This was a group of people that just signed an agreement for 5 years to come to Oakland, and a hotel community that is more than welcoming to bring in these new consumers to show off our town. And I just want to add to that, the Emerald Cup is a great marker for Oakland, but it's our trail that's, it really should be a trail that's not only used for April 20th for 420 day. It's a trail that's year round, that our marketing department is constantly adding content and we're bringing influencers and making our story a 365 day story that will hopefully bring in more Emerald Cups into the city of Oakland.
Yeah, fascinating. So Oakland starting to do it right. Santa Ana starting to do it right here. Brian, give us some other examples of either DMOs or areas outside of California that are doing this right, cannabis tourism, marketing it right, selling it right, and having that success.
Yeah, I do think, I think Visit Oakland and Travel Santa Ana really are like leading in a lot of ways, and Visit Mendocino County. That legacy producing region of Mendocino and Humboldt is an incredible asset for the state of California specifically. There's also like the Kootenai Rocky region I did a body of work for up in Canada. That was really education heavy, did a similar body of work for Hello Burlington. I believe that first step of getting your destination organization team educated on what this is and starting to get the information so you could have internal discussions about what that next step is a really important phase one. That's often followed by know before you go information, providing visitors with what the laws are, letting them know where the best dispensaries are that are on brand, that create experiences above and beyond a transaction. That's all kind of the phase one content. And there's a handful of DMOs that are starting to wake up to that and do that in a really effective way. And then there's the more mature, right? There's the destinations like Travel Santa Ana, Visit Oakland, Visit Mendocino County that are really embracing this, creating trails, creating storytelling platforms, becoming a resource and engaging their cannabis stakeholders in really powerful ways. And it's a great time to be doing this in destinations like California, because the cannabis experience economy for the modern day, for the California way, the 3.0, you know, Amsterdam was 2.0. California is really about to crack open a whole new level of innovation in the cannabis experience economy of California. Cannabis today is seen as a travel trend in wellness, well-being, and balance with one foot in medical, one foot in leisure. It's got a hell of an audience. It's going to continue exponentially growing. And this plant reaches into, we have cannabis spas in California where it's topical applications, cannabis beverage bars, infused culinary dinners. Santa Ana has some cannabis sampling rooms that are about to come on board, which is the cannabis version of a wine tasting room. And yes, you have cannabis lounges that are inhalation as well. But when it comes to destinations in California, these two are leading it. San Francisco has some great content up as well. Visit Greater Palm Springs, took some steps forward. There's some great content stories coming out of West Hollywood. So really, yes, those are some of the destinations that are kind of leading the way.
Great. So Wendy, Santa Ana is relatively newer, but kind of gaining some traction here. How do you think of it from a marketing perspective, or what kind of sort of rules of the road, whether those are hard rules or soft rules, are you encouraging for the industry and for the area?
I feel like we're in probably phase 1.5, leaning into 2. Our city is looking at allowing a cannabis event, not to the scale of the Emerald Cup, but that would be this fall. And so we're working with Brian. We had a seat at the table with economic development to discuss the RFPs that came in for the event to make sure it was a 2-day event that would draw potential overnight visitors, that it fit within a brand, that it had a Santa Ana name and not a general Orange County name. So we vetted those RFPs. Now it has to go before city council. Even though our city is allowed 31 approximately dispensaries, the idea of an event is still a little scary for some, especially the city council, because they're not the same city council that allowed and voted for the dispensaries to begin with, and with election coming up. So it's getting educating. It's all about education. So once we know when it's going to go to city council for approval, we will be at the ready to provide them with data about the travelers, about the economic impact, how we're going to market it. Because we look at it as 3 tiers, the city taking the resident marketing and educating them about the benefits. Cannabis dispensaries brought in $12 million into Santa Ana, $1.5 million more than our hotels in taxes. So educating the community about those general funds that go to youth programs, arts and culture. And so educating the residents about the importance of the cannabis tax. Then the event organizer has the marketing and experience of marketing to their audience, and then us marketing to draw overnight visitors to our hotels. I think the hardest so far, and I'm anxiously awaiting for Emerald Cup to happen so that I can glean some best practices from Peter and Visit Oakland, because so far our hotels, we have all brand name hotels. And so far there's been resistance because you have brands, you have owners, and you have management companies. And no one wants to be that first. So we have decided, initially we were going to have this whole thing about hotels that are cannabis friendly. I think it's too soon. So we're just letting the hotels, if this event gets approved, which we all are very hopeful that it will, our next step for our hotels is to educate them about what to expect. Here's what your front desk needs to do. Here's what your housekeeping needs to do. The hoteliers from a brand need to be addressed on this, because Marriott, Hilton, all of those, they need to have a lesson in cannabis and what it's doing and how it's impacting the economic vitality of local communities that allow this, so that they're not so scared. But it can't be a general manager trying to fight with an owner, trying to fight with a management company going up to an owner.
Many are owned by private equity firms. If you show them the money, they might be interested. What is actually legal to market? What isn't legal? And also, how do you get around the stigma if you're marketing this? This is not reefer madness, getting high in your hotel room, although plenty of people are doing that. How do you broaden the message? Let's do the legals first, and then we'll get into the
sure, message. Like what's legal, what's not.
Yeah.
So when it comes to cannabis, especially on the leisure travel side, 21 and up. Right? So you got to look at audiences, 21 and up, it's got to be about 70%, kind of meet that criteria. When it comes to travel experiences, I really look at it, I look at kind of the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco as the jump off point. It's been an attraction. That story has been a cultural story in California for decades. So what is the extension of that story? Because cannabis has played an incredible role in our state, you know, starting with the development of the missions and still having hemp artifacts and things like this. So the 21 and up, you basically, when you do create content, let's just imagine that all the know before you go content, all the risk mitigation, public safety, hospitality industry safety content is created and on your website. That next suite of content is really about experience, on brand for the destination, of course, and talking about culture, right? So being able to speak from a cultural lens. Oakland has an amazing story to tell with DEI and equity. They were the first licensed equity cannabis shop in the world. And that's a story that ties back into cannabis activism and human rights. And we're able to tell that kind of cultural ethos story through the cannabis trail and through the story of cannabis. Visit Mendocino County, very similar. Decades old, the brain trust of cannabis and the cannabis plants up there is incredible. It's also one of the deepest genetics banks in the world. And when you start looking at cannabis, as each seed has a different chemical composition, and cannabis was part of the US pharmacopoeia from 1850 to 1941. It was on pharmacy shelves up until 1937 before prohibition. You start understanding that, wow, when you look at the Emerald Triangle, Humboldt County, Mendocino County, Trinity County, they have one of the deepest vaults of genetics from around the world with cannabis. What does that mean from a leisure travel point of view? Absolutely. But what about medical travel? And what kind of opportunities are there as the California cannabis Appalachians start coming on board, which have been in development for 4 years and are supposed to flip live this year, just like wine AVAs in the state?
Yeah, I want to get into that too, because that could be a potential game changer when you get an Appalachian like you do for the great wines up in Napa and Santa Barbara and beyond. You mentioned data. Data is everything these days, and it's especially important in sort of a new type industry where you're trying to make these proving points. I know you're super passionate about it. I know you've done a lot of data collection. You just mentioned an example. But what data should DMOs be looking at? And what data should these folks look at? And where can they find it if they're interested in following along? Because that is going to be probably the gold mine for proving that this might be worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it starts with the cannabis travel audience, right? Understanding the audience size, who they are, what are the archetypes, and what does that mean against your DMO brand? And then really understanding what your assets are in your market against all that information, right? How many cannabis shops or lounges or spas or sampling spots do you have that's part of the visitor economy or the tourist track? Are there any that are even located in tourist centers, right? And starting to circle these from a geographic strategic point of view. That being said, there are, in cannabis, sometimes destinations have developed it in kind of a marginalized way where they put you in the industrial zone. And there are some destinations that you can make, it is travel worthy to go out to those. So there are outliers. But understanding what experiences exist in the tourist track and starting to analyze and assess that, and then reach out to those stakeholders and start developing relationships so you can create a program around it and be a guide to teach them what it means to not just be a transactional retailer, but to go above and beyond and consider yourself an experience creator for the visitor spend, for the visitor experience, above and beyond a resident spend. So the cannabis travel audience in relationship to your destination brand and your cannabis stakeholder assets and kind of where they lie. The second data set would really be kind of what, like, Zartico's done this, Tourism Economics has dove into this as well, is understanding and geofencing kind of the human movement. Who's going to the dispensaries or the cannabis shops or the lounges? How are they moving about? What time of day? What time of year? What season? Is it peaking during 420? How do you make it an evergreen platform where you're leaning into pre-existing programs and narratives? Like, a great example of this is Restaurant Week. Right? Everyone can relate to, like, the munchies are one of the most well-known things when it comes to cannabis. So how can you maybe position the lounges as an aperitif or a pre-dinner experience to stimulate your appetite, accentuate your palate, and take that restaurant week to the next level while you try those local signature dishes? Is there a way to integrate a cannabis narrative into a pre-existing thing so it becomes part of your destination story in a brand-aligned way? And that's the benefit of reaching out to the cannabis stakeholders and starting to work with them and guide them. Oakland did this great too. We are doing this great with the Emerald Cup, right? This is an economic impact between $17 and $20 million that happened in Santa Rosa. Now that event is home to Oakland. And the Emerald Cup team is ecstatic because Visit Oakland has wrapped their arms around it with hotel partners and marketing support and media strategy. And all of a sudden, you have this kind of synergistic relationship unfolding. So the cannabis travel audience, what does it mean for your destination? How do you want to architect out your strategy and program? Is it straight marketing content driven, or do you want to do stakeholder outreach and kind of become a data-driven community alignment vehicle? We talk a lot in DI about that. And then layer on that human movement. I think the third pillar is, how is this, specifically lounges and cannabis consumption spaces, what is that next step? because some of the data is showing, the last Portrait of the American Traveler study we did in July 2023, we saw a really compelling data point that's connecting cannabis as a precursor to a food experience, like we just touched on with Restaurant Week, but also cannabis as a precursor to arts and culture, right? Because there are certain types of cannabis varietals where it enhances shapes and colors, and it makes things more thought-provoking. It brings you into the present moment. How is that translating to economic impact throughout the destination, where the cannabis traveler is dropping money, not just in a lounge in a shop, but they're being sent on a curated experience throughout the ecosystem, and they're dropping money elsewhere? Of course, heads and beds, right? One thing I learned, I've been in 10 years now kind of learning the travel industry, and learned that obviously heads and beds, overnight stays is incredibly important. So both of these destinations, and also Visit Mendocino County, one place that we're at in the programs, is identifying kind of the cannabis-friendly hotels and starting to geofence those to really see where's that resting cell phone spot and how many heads and beds are being translated from the cannabis travel audience and the program that we've created. And then how do you support with unlocking incremental revenue?
So in the winery world, the question is, or the statement, the owner of the winemaker is often the face of the brand. Story is often the story of the winery. And it helps the storytelling front. Is there an equivalent in the cannabis industry? There probably is. I know there is, but I'm sure you have an example you can share that you can point to for the crowd, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, we're actually upon that era. If what I'm hearing is accurate, you know, for four years, they've been developing the Cannabis Appellation Program of California. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has been working on this. They've looked at Bordeaux. They've looked at Champagne, France. They've also looked at Manuka honey, because of the medicinal properties of that and what they did in New Zealand around that. So there's been a lot of interesting case studies around how do we develop this Appellation of Origin program when it comes to cannabis in California. So you're going to start seeing these appellations roll out. I think that obviously this is an immense opportunity for California. And for me, it transcends cannabis. It really is an opportunity for us to highlight the agricultural positioning of our state, whether it's grapes, whether it's artichokes. We have an amazing state when it comes to growing food and growing medicine. Cannabis happens to have this friction that gets amazing earned media. And if we tell our story right and continually kind of, you know, coaching the cannabis industry of California on how to dovetail in to the California brand, as well as the local DMO brands here, we can all be singing off the same song sheet. It's an amazing opportunity. We need to understand that cannabis is a travel trend today that's grounded in wellness and well-being and balance. And it transcends inhalation and getting high. It's a whole new ball game. So getting spun up and understanding the cards in your deck and how you can play these strategically, it's a great time to be proactive with that.
Great. Congratulations to us for not dropping too many puns into this conversation. We had a $20 penalty, but we made it. Special thanks to Peter Gámez from Visit Oakland, Wendy Hazy-Roberts from Santa Ana, and to Brian Appelgarth. And thank you for being here. Thanks to Visit California. Thanks for having us. Get home safe.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. And this week's term comes to us from President Biden, no less. And that term is CFIUS. It's an acronym, I know. And it stands for the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which is part of the U.S. Treasury Department. The president said last week that he opposes the sale of U.S. steel to Nippon Steel, a Japanese conglomerate, although he did not specifically mention that he would try to block the $14.9 billion deal. He said through an email statement, quote, "It is important that we maintain strong American steel companies powered by American steel workers. U.S. Steel has been an iconic American steel company for more than a century, and it is vital for it to remain an American steel company that is domestically owned and operated." In opposing the sale, Biden sided with the United Steelworkers Union, which has been no fan of the deal since it was announced. While Nippon Steel said it would honor existing contracts, the union is not convinced. It's an election year, as we know, and President Biden has called his White House, quote, "the most pro-union administration in American history," end quote. Remember, he did side with the United Auto Workers last summer. It's very rare and very difficult for a president to block a deal between publicly traded companies. It's only happened 6 times since 2008. But if the president does want to block this, he'll do it through CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, our term of the week, and we'll be watching this deal very closely. We're going to let Professor Milton Friedman take us out this week. The Nobel Prize winning economist, who is an expert on monetary history and theory, had a unique gift for finding just the right metaphor to describe economic paradigms. Here's the professor in a clip from the Free to Choose Network with his explanation of inflation. It's pretty timely given the Fed meeting this week and the sticky state of interest rates.
Inflation is just like alcoholism. In both cases, when you start drinking or when you start printing too much money, the good effects come first. The bad effects only come later. That's why, in both cases, there's a strong temptation to overdo it, to drink too much and to print too much money. When it comes to the cure, it's the other way around. When you stop drinking or when you stop printing money, the bad effects come first and the good effects only come later. That's why it's so hard to persist with the cure.
We may just be dealing with an inflation hangover, and it may be lasting much longer than we expected. Thanks for joining us this week, as always, and special thanks to Visit California for allowing me to host that fascinating conversation and share it with you. We'll link to Visit California's site in the show notes to find the whole conversation and all the reports we cited on this week's episode. Find those show notes wherever you ride the express, and we'll talk again a little further on down the line.